Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Poems of Vocation, presented by Mark Schwain. Disc number SCM-2005-01.
It always feels odd that you say this, and you're not sure if anybody is there, but Antonio or Reed, run the table. Welcome. I'm Mark Schwain, and have served the village in various capacities this summer. I was village philosopher last week, and I'm sort of utility infielder this week, doing this session and helping my wife, who's the program summer teaching staff coordinator, in different ways. And I'm offering this session today on poems of vocation, and before distributing them and talking about the two poems, I thought I'd give you a little bit of a background and solicit your counsel and aid on a project that's underway. About 5 years ago, the Lilly Endowment decided to give away what turned out. Come on in. Have a seat around the table. We're just getting underway, so you have not missed the thing. We haven't even distributed the poems yet. I was just giving everybody a little bit of sort of a framework here for this discussion. Anyway, they sponsored a program which turned out to be about a $200 million investment of giving grants to colleges and universities called PTEV grants. That's an acronym for the Program in the Theological Exploration of Vocation. Lilly has worried about two things in its history, especially. One is leadership within churches. So vocation in the narrower sense of church work, especially ordained ministry, has been a concern. What's happening to the quality of ordained ministry in this country? And the other issue is the whole question of young people in colleges and universities at kind of pivotal transitional point in their life. Do these people have a vocabulary, a way of thinking through fundamental questions like having to do with their identity? Who am I? What is my purpose in life? What should I think about doing with my gifts, etc.? And again, the vocabulary of vocation, as that's been developed in the Christian tradition, was thought by Lilly to be a kind of useful way of addressing those kinds of fundamental questions, which perhaps not enough colleges and universities are doing as much as they should. So the two parts of this, better people who wind up in callings that have to do with church work, and a kind of conversation on campuses that has to do with everybody's calling, broadly understood, were something they sought to foster with these grants. And they basically gave them to schools on the basis of a kind of competitive proposals where schools ran all kinds of different programs, some having to do with courses, some having to do with co-curricular activities like retreats or work-study programs or trips abroad or chapel programs that had to do with social justice issues through praxis, but also then some reflection to broaden students' horizons and the kinds of things they might do, etc. Well, very soon after these programs got launched, there was a hunger for different kinds of literature to examine as people began to develop courses. And out of that grew a two-part initiative, the first part of which just came yesterday to me. Bill Plaper, who teaches theology at Wabash College, has put together this anthology of readings, which is entitled Callings, and the subtitle is, I'll pass this around, 20 Centuries of Christian Wisdom on Vocation. So it's a treasury of writers from the very beginning, it starts with some biblical texts, up to the present day, who who have written about, thought about this whole matter of vocation. And as a companion volume to that, a book that Arand, come on up, there's room here at the table. There's always room at the table. Very old. So please do pull up a chair. I haven't even gotten to the poems yet, so you haven't missed anything. I'll pass this around. As a companion volume to that, Dorothy and I, my wife and I, are working on an anthology that is largely drawing on non-religious texts, meaning that they don't grow directly and self-consciously out of the Christian tradition, though some do, because what has happened, I think, is that the whole idea of vocation, like the whole idea of redemption, let's say, vocabularies that originally had a kind of anchorage in a religious tradition, have now got wide public prominence. I mean, a lot of people talk about their calling or their vocation or their destiny or some kind of vocabulary like that, which was once perhaps anchored in a religious tradition but isn't any longer, but still has elements of that. So we're supposed to draw together texts that aren't explicitly religious, but that deepen people's comprehension of basic questions, especially the college students, but also people at different stages of transition in their life are bound to ask, like, what ought to be the primary source of my life's meaning? Should it be my paid employment? Or are there other things that finally determine who I am, et cetera, et cetera? Those basic questions. So anyway, in the course of putting that book together, we've come up with a number of lyric poems, short poems, that we think really do open up very well. Have a seat. Do open up very well this broad subject of vocation. So one more word of introduction, and then we'll look at the poems. I brought two today. Bill Plaker makes the point in his book that even within the Christian tradition, there have been historically very different understandings of what it meant to have a calling or a vocation. Very different. The Christian tradition hasn't spoken with one voice about this matter. And he basically divides the book into four historical sections when he thinks that a certain understanding of vocation was dominant in these four successive huge historical periods. And I think it's useful just to say something about that, because you're going to find some of the resonance in these poems of these different ways of thinking about vocation. Plaker argues that for the first 500 years, roughly, of Christian history, from the time the New Testament kind of took shape up until around 500-600 AD, the basic question for Christians was, were they called from a pagan to a Christian way of life? So the basic existential question was, am I going to become a Christian in a largely pagan world? Okay, when Christianity was still marginal, minority status, et cetera, et cetera. Then roughly for the next millennium of Christian history, roughly from 500 to 1500, the question was, do I have a calling, meaning do I have a religious calling? Am I one of those whom God has singled out to become a priest, a nun, et cetera? So in other words, it had a narrower understanding now within the Christian community. Do I have a calling to the religious life? Okay. And that's sort of what some of the reformers inherit as the meaning of vocation, when, of course, along come Luther and Calvin and others who open up this whole notion that it's not just a few who have calling, those who are summoned to a religious life professionally. We all have calling. We all are called to certain stations or placed in certain social vocations as parents and as children, as neighbors, as citizens, as people who do different forms of paid employment. And all of these dimensions are callings laid upon us by God. And we understand the sort of meaning and the significance of those tasks wherever we are stationed, as something we're summoned to do as part of a divine plan by which Almighty God sustains and nourishes creation. So God sees to it that neighbors are served through our own hands and eyes and ears and feet in these various places that we've been stationed, as I named a bunch of those social stations before. So the ultimate source of the call then under this account is, of course, God. The aim of the call is to, well, roughly human flourishing, or the common good, depending on who you're talking about, okay, serving the neighbor's need. And, of course, to take some contemporary idioms, it's thought that the calling is also something in which my own deep gladness, to quote Buechner, meets the world's deepest need. Okay? That's a kind of belated notion in Protestantism. The early writers were basically concerned about responding to God's love and serving the neighbor. They didn't have much in the early documents about anything having to do with self-fulfillment or our own deep gladness, etc. But that has kind of gradually crept into this understanding of vocation. This is what I mean. It's taken on a larger prominence. And in the process, it's not just that the secular vocabulary has become, in a way, infused with Christian notions. It's that Christian notions themselves have gotten more expansive, for better or for worse, due to secular ways of speaking about this. And I think the Buechner formulation represents that kind of influence already. This book, Just Work, just work's a nice pun, meaning just work, is it just? And just work, is that all that we are, just our work? Is brand new, written by a guy who, so far as I know, is not a Christian, and who's a political theorist, and who talks about, if you want a short definition, what is just work? It's work that's fitting in two respects. It's fit for me, that is to say, the deep gladness part. It suits who I am as a human being, but it's fitting for society. That is, it's kind of meeting a social need. It's part of a whole system whereby what I do fits a larger pattern of needs that's out there. Well, that's a completely secular account, and yet if you look at Buechner's formula, it's almost exactly parallel to that account. My deep gladness, world's deep need, he says, fitting for me, fitting for the world. So you can see this kind of development going on, and it's in the midst of that development that we're trying to develop this book, which we hope will present people with texts that don't provide easy answers, but that deepen their sense of what a calling really is. And we pick these short forms, which happily we can distribute and read aloud together and then discuss. So we're going to start with, I think I'd have to say, the best poem I have found that comes out of a person's work, Robert Frost, who's not known for his Orthodox Christianity, though he certainly is conversant with Christianity. And it's the best contemporary, meaning 20th century poem I know, that deepens and complicates our understanding of what vocation might be. So I want to talk about this as a poem, figure out what's going on in it, and if there's time, we'll get to the Margaret Percy. I'm not going to drive us through this. I'm going to stick with it until we feel like we're ready to move on. And if we're only getting to this, you'll get the other one as a gift at the end for your contributions and so on. It's 9 stanzas. It's a little long, but I think it helps to hear it. Does anybody love to read poetry? I mean, I'll read it myself, but would you like to read this for us? Your name is?
Karen.
Karen? Okay. Please.
Out of the mud, two strangers came and caught me splitting wood in the yard. And one of them put me off my aim by hailing cheerily, "Hit him hard." I knew pretty well why he dropped behind and let the other go on away. I knew pretty well what he had in mind. He wanted to take my job for pay. Good blocks of oak it was I split, as large around as the chopping block, and every piece I squared a hit fell splinterless as a cloven rock. the blows that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good. That day, giving a loose to my soul, I spent on the unimportant wood. The sun was warm, but the wind was chill. You know how it is with an April day when the sun is out and the wind is still. You're 1 month on in the middle of May. But if you so much as dare to speak, a cloud comes over the sunlit arch. A wind comes off a frozen peak, and you're 2 months back in the middle of March. A bluebird comes tenderly up to a light and turns to the wind to unruffle a plume, his song so pitched as not to excite a single flower as yet to bloom. It is snowing a flake, and he half knew winter was only playing possum. Except in color, he isn't blue, but he wouldn't advise a thing to blossom. The water for which we may have to look in summertime with a witching wand, in every wheel rut's now a brook, in every print of a hoof, a pond. Be glad of water, but don't forget the lurking frost in the earth beneath that will steal forth after the sun is set and show on the water its crystal tint. The time when most thy loved might ask, these two must make me love it more by coming with what they came to ask. You'd think I never had felt before the weight of an axe head poised aloft, the grip on earth of outspread feet, the life of muscles rocking soft and smooth and moist in vernal heat. Out of the woods, two hulking tramps from sleeping God knows where last night, but not long since in the lumber camps. They thought all chopping was theirs of right. Men of the woods and lumberjacks, they judged me by their appropriate tool. Except as a fellow handled an axe, they had no way of knowing the fool. Nothing on either side was said. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head, as that I had no right to play with what was another man's work for gain. My right might be love, theirs was need. And where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right, agreed. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes.
Thank you. Very nice. Very nice. Just so that we can be sort of focused in our conversation about the poem, it's interesting to divide it into sort of units. I mean, obviously the stanzas do that, but I think the poem has certain major parts to it. The first two stanzas I submit to you is part one, because this introduces the characters and sets up the narrative situation. We're getting little characters introduced and a little story. But then we get at least three stanzas in which we basically talk about the time of the year. We hear about a bluebird, which is connected to the time of the year. So we basically get reflections on nature at that time. The sun, the wind, water, basic elemental natural things are described in great detail. Not much narrative momentum here, except for the sort of the bluebird coming in and singing. I think this next stanza, it's hard to know whether that now begins a new part, because there's still talk about the time. It looks like that belongs with the preceding three, because now it looks like we get two stanzas that resume the narrative and that begin pretty much the same way that the first two stanzas began. Out of the woods, two hulking tramps, and the first, out of the mud, two strangers came. So it looks like now we're kind of going back now and picking up the narrative line, okay? So it looks like those two stanzas there continue the narrative that we began in the first two stanzas and then sort of interrupted with all this description. And then we get, it seems to be the last stanza, which is a kind of meditation, in a way, the speaker interpreting the significance, the meaning of the narrative that he himself has been telling about himself and the two tramps. Fair enough? That's a rough kind of approximation. I'm not sure what to do with the top stanza on that back page. I think it belongs with the other three, but I think it's also sort of transitional. But anyway, let's look at the first opening narrative here. And the title, Two Tramps in Mud Time. My question here of the first two stanzas is, why Mud Time? This poem is almost obsessively about time. If you count the number of times, it, summertime, time of the season, this time, that time, it really is very heavy with temporality. So there are many ways that he could have entitled the poem having to do with time. I mean, notice he begins that second narrative, out of the woods, two hulking tramps. There's no sign of mud time there. But here, out of the mud, two strangers came. Why is that?
I grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and mud time is you come out of the Minnesotans know this. It's a you come out of the cold cabin, and you're out, and it's messy, but you're out and about and beginning the work for the year, in a sense, for the summer. So it's a kind of activity and planning and muck, and it's dirty.
Do people talk this way? Is this a colloquial expression? And people say, well, it's mud time now.
Mud season.
They use that term, mud season,
in my world.
So it's a kind of descriptive colloquialism. I mean, in many ways he could have, and it refers to, as you say, time for the beginning of work, the year is work.
There's that transition in the spring too, between, you know, you have the solidity of the snow and ice, and it's maybe partly there yet, under the ground or in patches, but you haven't yet gotten the green and the solid brown that comes as things dry out and snow ice goes away. So there's that transition time, and you see that transition time too among the workers here.
So why would a poem, if we think, and we haven't decided this, but if we think the poem is about vocation, given the meditations in the last stanza, why mud time? Why set the poem at this time of year? And why call it mud time? What's the connection between its being about vocation and its being called Tramps in Mud Time? You've given us one partial answer, because it's the time that begins a year of work, which suggests that vocation really is, in the world of this poem, connected to physical labor, okay? Not the parenting or citizenship or other things, but physical labor.
But if you're willing to let us go into the next section.
You can peek at the next section.
the bit about time as well, it's a month on to the middle of May, but it could go back to March. And mud is that kind of, it's not just transitional, it's ambivalent. It's an ambivalent state of being. It's not one thing, it's not another thing, it's a between thing.
Transition.
Yeah, but it could go either way. And often we think maybe that's incorrect, but we think of transition from one thing to the next. This could go either way. And certainly the whole poem has that sense about, well, whose work is it and why should you get to do it? If it were a different poet and we were expecting lots of biblical references, there could also be the making the human being out of the mud.
Well, I don't know why we wouldn't think that.
Be careful about imposing too quickly.
No, it seems to me that, I mean, for example, a poem's last line.
Oh, well, yeah.
Is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sake? So we take the first line invoking mud time, the last line invoking heaven. It does seem to me we do have some warrant within the text, never mind whether Frost is himself explicitly letting out a Christian sentiment here. of framing literally this whole narrative with heaven and mud time, that from which human beings arose. It's interesting to know why there are two tramps in the end. Why not just a tramp? There are two of them who come out of the mud. Now, I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. It made me think right away of the strangers in Abraham.
Mm-hmm. It's another story.
And then especially when we had been vomit, is that either we had done for the teacher's sake and that, you know, the message that they brought.
So these people who just kind of emerge out of some mysterious source and are there.
And the thinking that Abraham and Sarah, you know, have fallen.
Interesting, I hadn't thought of that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so at least there's kind of a resonance in this poem of a kind of biblical world. Not only that, but there's a resonance here of a spiritual dimension to this vocation, with heaven being invoked at the end and this kind of sudden appearance out of the ground, out of the mud, or in mud time of these two tramps. Okay, so let's stick with the first here, this first two stanzas. He reads them, he reads their minds. And there's no direct discourse between them. All of this kind of thing goes on within the speaker's head. Later tells us that he knew what their logic was. He knows why the one lingers behind, he says. He knows what he had in mind, he says. He wanted to take the job for pay. Well, fine. Next stanza, good blocks of oak was I split, as large around as the chopping block, and every piece I squarely hit fell splinterless as a cloven rock. Now, this next section is what I want us to paraphrase first, and then talk about what's going on. The blows that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good, that day, giving a loose to my soul, I spent on the unimportant wood. Why is the wood unimportant in this context of these four lines? So it's unimportant. The wood is unimportant relative to the trams?
No, because it's important to them. The wood is also important to the trams.
Okay, so then are you saying I spent on the unimportant wood, it's unimportant to the speaker?
Yeah, we talk about sins of omission and sins of commission, and maybe here it was an omission to share this work.
Okay, so you think that he's already at that point in the choice of the word unimportant wood, beginning to feel guilty that he's not offering one of these two people the opportunity to do the job for pay?
Possibly.
You're shaking your head no there. So let's
Oh, all right.
What do you think?
Well, it does need to be paraphrased to be a simple sentence, but what came to my mind was easy way that I was trying to think of saying this is like volunteerism, something that you would give up of yourself that would create the common good or community, as he's channeling on the wood, and in that sense it's unimportant compared to whatever he's associating with the common good.
No, that's interesting. That's an interesting thought. Now, so just to be clear now, it's unimportant in what sense? It's merely volunteer,
well,
not
compared to the common good thing.
Oh, okay.
The blows that your life might strike for your own good would be one thing, and he's talking about blows that you would strike that would create something in common, and instead he's using those urges or that energy on the good.
Okay, that's very interesting. So we could, let me see if I'm getting this straight. We've got the Mavericks out here, and part of their job, or the common good of the village, is to go and chop wood out there in the wood chopping field. Okay? What you're suggesting is that so wood could be chopped to serve the common good, but it also could be chopped unimportantly as it happens.
You might just be
just for the just for the sheer joy of feeling a sense of labor and accomplishment, never mind serving anybody.
Yeah.
Right. It's avocation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Versus vocation.
Nice. Okay. So you spare in a life of self-control. By self-control, you might ordinarily always want to do things just for yourself, but you have self-control, you don't give way to those impulses, you serve common good. But here, in this particular case, he's out there chopping wood just for the sheer intrinsic pleasure of chopping wood for himself, okay? Never mind the common good. That's the word unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
Unimportant for the common good.
Or, even since it's spring, he may not even need to use it himself.
Exactly,
right?
Very nice.
So if you were doing it in the fall, then you'd say, well, it's nice to do this, but also I need it if I'm going to be warm tonight. But in the spring, maybe it is just because I want to. So it's not even...
Good. Another reason that's important is mud time, because out there chopping wood in mud time, might not even be useful to you, never mind useful to others, right?
But there's a lot of unknown.
Material.
It might go back to March.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It'd be cold tonight.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah.
Which is a very nice point. I mean, it gets into what was going to be my next set of questions. Why dwell on this strange season of the year? And if you're right, that chopping wood either takes on usefulness to yourself or not, depending on whether it's spring coming or whether it's still winter, then of course this kind of movement back and forth in the season, you're either a month ahead in May or you're 2 months behind in March, 2 months behind May in March, it's more or less useful to yourself to be chopping wood. Never mind the common wood.
Materially useful.
Right, materially useful, exactly.
But you can't wait to get outside.
Yeah.
So you just want to do it. It's a moment that you want to grasp.
Too early to plant.
Yeah, you can't do that.
And do the dishes all
the sun is warm. it's a nice time. I'm sorry I came in late, but I just want to comment. I don't know if you said this. In New England, it's the only place in the country where I've run across mud rooms. So, did we hear that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So, mud room is a concept. At least we in Oregon don't have a mud room. So, that sort of defines this interesting time where you transition from, a muddy mud room into the house. Isn't that way all year round? You all know that, I guess, from Midwest, too.
That's good, thank you.
Yes.
Yes, we, in fact, for a while it was a big selling point if your house didn't have a mud room. Now you might not get anybody to look at it. Where was the mud room? I remember that very vividly. For our last house, this house has a mud room.
There's the Arizona room, and there's the mud room.
Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to skip these intervening four stanzas, okay? And we're going to, of the three stanzas, and we're going to come to this stanza at the top, which I'm not sure whether to put with the three preceding ones or next. So I want to pick up at the top of page two. The time when most I love my task. These two must make me love it more by coming with what they came to ask. You'd think I had never felt before the weight of an accent poised aloft, the grip on earth with outspread feet, the light muscles rocking soft and smooth and moist in firm heat. So now this is a very complicated notion here. It's a time when he loves his task the most. Now most is a superlative, but these two must make me love it more by coming with what they had to ask. Now, how does that work?
The Tom Sawyer thing.
Very nice. So, you want to remind the rest? You're talking about the whitewashing of the old fence. Explain that story. That's a very nice, very apt comparison.
I don't know if there's anything more to it. Just
well, not everybody may know.
We may not remember this. Looks like more fun when someone else is doing it. It's a task, but it's come an offer to help and, this is mine. No, this is mine. Get to do this.
And you trade an apple for
Yeah, you get a bunch of good
give
stuff.
Give me your apple core. Give me your apple core.
he uses this, he has to whitewash the fence at Tom Sawyer. He's very upset. Aunt Polly's given him this task, and so he gets this idea as he begins to whitewash, and he seems just riveted by the task, and another boy comes and kind of watches and makes fun of him and says, well, why don't you come out and play? Oh, no, I'd much rather do this. he just loves it. And so eventually all these boys come by and actually give Tom Sawyer something for the opportunity to whitewash. And at one point there's this line about whether it's work or whether it's play, and Tom says, I don't know whether it's work or whether it's play, but it sure suits Tom Sawyer. So it's this, it is this notion then that others want to do it, you're suggesting, that makes it more joyful for him. Yes.
Isn't that somewhat manipulative? He did this. It's more fun for him when he got to do it. He got them to do it, and he didn't have to. I don't feel like this in this one.
Good. Good. That would be a difference. But now, explain to me why then, what are the dynamics that these guys want to do it for pay that would make him take more pleasure in doing it for the sheer delight of it? That's what I'm trying to...
Because it's a choice. He's choosing to do this and realizing that he has the choice to pay someone else to do it or makes it more precious. He has to go through that process of saying, well, I'm choosing to do this, I must enjoy it, or...
Very nice.
How I'm spending my time.
Very nice. The second chapter of that book, Just Work, is all about the crucial importance for us to have just work that it be chosen, and that it be chosen well. Okay? So what you're saying is that when he suddenly realizes, even though he's taking the light, all of that feeling of the muscles and the abs raise aloft and all that, those feelings were there before. But now that someone else is doing it out of necessity, needs to make money. That person's under the whip hand of necessity, need, okay? And the fact that now his presence there, saying nothing, suddenly makes this person self-conscious of the fact that he's chosen to do this, hasn't been forced to do this, and that adds a dimension of pleasure to the great pleasure he's already feeling. Mm-hmm. That seem to make sense?
Yeah. Also that he might lose it. It's not just that he chose it, but that he might now be compelled by moral force to let someone else do it.
Right. Okay.
I like the thought of awareness. You know, he loves the physical sensation. I love the chocolate, so I can really identify with this. Mm-hmm. And his feet are pressed against the ground, and he just loves that. And now he becomes aware of it when he thinks these guys would like to take it away from me. And I love to do this, and now I really realize how much I love to do this when I realize these guys would like to have it. Mm-hmm. It's that inner dynamic and the self-awareness of this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he just does it because he loves it. But now, the fact that they want to take it away makes him think, gosh, I really love doing this. And these guys want to pay for it. That's a shame, he's thinking.
So the intrinsic pleasure one takes in an activity becomes more enhanced, A, if you suddenly realize it could be taken away, and B, if you suddenly realize that this is really out of choice that I'm doing. So I'm kind of freedom. Mm-hmm. And those add extra dimensions that make what was most loved even more. Very nice. Okay, now we begin the narrative again. Out of the woods, two hulking tramps from sleeping God knows where last night, but not long since in the lumber camps. How do you think, as I read the rest of this, how does he think, the tramps think, about the relationship between a person's character and the kind of work they do? Okay? How does he think the tramps think about the relationship between a person's character and the kind of work they do? Okay? They thought all chopping was theirs of right. Men of the woods and lumberjacks, they judged me by their appropriate tool. except as a fellow handled an axe, they had no way knowing a fool. How does he think, the tramps think, the people who chop wood for money, about the relationship between what they do, chopping wood, that's why he makes the point that they slept recently in a lumber camp, okay? What they do for a living, so to speak, and who they are as human beings, what their character is like. Does he think about the relationship between those two and the lumberjack's mind?
I was a lumberjack for 3 summers, mm-hmm. one of them up here back in the 70s mm-hmm. and 80s. As with any skill, you know, it's a skill, and you can tell it immediately whether somebody's got it. And so their world, I see this as they're judging him, and they're evaluating him, and they have this view of him. He thinks it's a narrow kind of view based on their skill. And I wonder if he feels self-conscious a bit. Here he is doing something he loves. He has 2 people who are experts looking at him, and suddenly that enters into the equation.
Yeah.
And the last line there, they had no way of knowing the fool, mm-hmm. other than how they handled the axe. That was his one way, or their one way of knowing this gentleman. It's just that when, you know, the word fool, it tells me that he was feeling probably a little insecure.
Good. Yes.
Well, I see that going back to the first thing where they tell him, hit him hard. Like, you know what you're doing, hit him hard. You know, we know better. So that would be where he would feel foolish.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm. But why do you feel foolish? Because back then the second toe sounds up. He's like, every piece I swear to hit tells splinters. Mm-hmm. Hold the rock, which means he was very skilled. And we didn't have to hit it twice, we just did it.
Do you think that every piece I squarely hit means that he hit every piece squarely, or that of the pieces he hit, the ones that he hit squarely fell into nice halves like a clothing line? We don't know whether that was 1 in 100 or, you know, right? I mean, it's a. He could either mean I hit every piece squarely, or every piece that I squarely hit fell this way. But I'm not telling you what a high percentage of them, right? And so the fact that the guy's yell hit him hard, having observed him, may mean that it isn't a really high percentage that are falling like cloven rocks, right? Now, this question about the tramp's perspective on thinking that his character, is he a fool or a wise man, is really measurable primarily by what he does and how well he does it, in this case, chopping wood. Is that different from, you know, when we go up to dinner and new villagers come in and we pass the food around, we say, hi, I'm Dan, and someone says, hi, I'm Sue. What's the next question? So where are you from? And then what do you do, right? So our sort of American way, this is thought impolite in other countries, okay? But our way of getting quickly to character is what you do for a living, right?
Very quickly, it will be, did you scrape your plates well?
That's right.
Did you look, those people, I bet you both, they not only didn't scrape their plates, but they did their silverware wrong.
Did a terrible job, right? What kind of human beings are these? They can't scrape a plate here.
They don't understand sorting the silverware.
Oh! Good. So in other words, the tramps, he thinks, and you think, having been actually a lumberjack in a few years, tend to view other people and make judgments about them as whether they're foolish or wise. Overall, global judgments about their character, as to, in this case, how well they handle an axe, right? out of your own. So they bring together identity and the kind of work you do and how well you do it, and kind of collapse that into one.
Based on a small piece of information.
Based on a small piece, exactly.
But I have to think that when you're being a lumberjack, you really don't want to fool on the other end of the saw.
And hit them hard is a funny little phrase now that we're talking about it. You know, back in the day, long ago, you don't really want to hit it hard, you want to hit it right. You know what I mean? You don't have to hit it hard, you have to hit it right. And so that, I never thought of that. But
were they
so,
trying to hit them hard?
Well, hit them hard is a veiled insult.
Yeah.
It could be viewed as that. It looks like you're really hitting hard, you fool. You know, you don't need to hit it hard, just hit it right.
Nice point. Yeah. Because the line before, one of them put me off my aim, as though what he was concentrating on is where to hit, not how hard to hit. Yeah. Very good. Okay, let's go back to our second narrative here. We haven't even gotten to the seasons. Nothing on either side was said. So this all goes on within the head. I think this is terrific. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head. So they stayed around long enough, my head would be their head. I mean, their logic would completely overtake me, which we think it's already started to do, given some of your earlier comments about him feeling uneasy, apprehensive, et cetera, et cetera. Or in some cases, taking even more delight in what he's doing already because of their presence. As that I had no right to play with what was another man's work or game. And where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right. Agreed. Okay? My right might be love, but theirs was need. And where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right. Agreed. All right, now let's go through this, talk about rights and play and work. So first of all, from the speaker's point of view, what was he doing before the tramps came? I mean, splitting wood. But was he working or was he playing?
Well, it was work as play.
Awesome.
Work is an expenditure of effort towards a concrete end. Now, I might do that just for the heck of it, or i.e. because I love to split wood. Or I might do it because we've got to have firewood, it has to be done, or Dad said, you got to split the wood, or I'll pay a quarter if you split, this kind of wood. So, but if you do it simply for the heck of it, for the joy of it, it's still work. It's the expenditure. But it's expanding the concept of work to something more, to use, again, his own language, vocation to avocation.
Okay, so we get back to your point about his consciousness that this suddenly is something he's doing out of choice rather than necessity. Remember when we asked what enhances his pleasure and you volunteered that. So now, are you suggesting, and do others think, yes, in some ways work can be defined very narrowly as expenditure of energy for a particular purpose, is that the way you put it? That can be called, let's say, labor, laboring at something. But if it's freely chosen and not done out of necessity, you can get up and leave any moment. Then it becomes what? Play, or it becomes a richer understanding of work. In the language of the poem, doesn't it look like he says, I had no right to play with what was another man's work or game? As though in the vocabulary of the poem, it looks like he thinks he's playing, or isn't that right?
Maybe it's their perspective.
Or what he imagines is
he's just so, yes.
But if you love your work, does it cease to become work? I mean, is it?
But that unimportant foot.
So it's not only that you, love it, it's that in a way it's more satisfying if it's not done for this instrumental purpose. Mm-hmm. So if it's non-instrumental, in other words, getting back to our point about he's not chopping the wood, probably, certainly not for the common good, and probably not even the time of year for himself. Mm-hmm. So that there's just a kind of intrinsic pleasure in the activity, which has its pleasure not as a result of some result or end, of which it's kind of useful for that end, okay? And it's freely chosen in that you didn't have to do it, so you could walk away any minute. Then it becomes, in the vocabulary of the poem, play, or playing work, to use something like your first formulation, and that you can get up and leave, okay? Now, he says, though, the speaker, and I'm wondering if we agree with the speaker here, that where there's that present, that whole state is something really, a kind of right, he says. My right might be love. But when you're in the presence of need, another who wants to do the same thing you're doing, but in order to make a living, needs to do that. That claim is stronger, or as he puts it here, theirs is the better right, agreed. Rest of you buy that? They really should have handed the axe over. They have a stronger right out of need than he does out of love.
Well, one interesting thing is the punctuation mark after a three. I'm surprised he doesn't put a question mark there. I.e., you agree that it's agreed? It may be the fact that he doesn't put a question mark there is what tickles our fancy, our wonderment. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you're right, he doesn't have a question mark, but the poem doesn't end there either.
No, it doesn't.
But it's displaying the fact here. Theirs is the better life, and he agrees with that, so he doesn't need a question mark. It's a fact.
Maybe.
But do you agree? I'm wondering if you agree with the speaker. I mean, it's clear that he believes that among these two, between these two competing rights, as he calls them, love and need, that the stronger is need. Translated into the kind of narrative of this poem, in a way, they're standing there.
He's taking bread out of their mouth.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. His right, and he should hand over the axe.
I think you could have just paid him to go away.
That's great. That would be charity.
It's a nice point. That would be something different, right?
It would not be paying them for something to do. It would be just
Well, you just stop laughing at me. Go away.
I think of volunteers in a social service agency who come from an affluent or middle class, a comfortable life, and they want to volunteer and they want to feel connected to the serving of others. So they come and they might help at a shelter or help at a service agency. Those service agencies have to have infrastructure in order to manage the wide skill levels and and interests and quirky personalities and egos of donors, and it's even more complicated if these donors have resources, money, that makes a real difference in those social service agencies that are much to those who want to give the time, which is important too in a way, but the money is much more flexible and much more pointed to effective and meaningful fulfillment of need. So that's, when I read that, I'm thinking about that, you know. You're going into volunteering because it helps you feel good. Well, okay, there's something to that, but there's problems with it too.
So, that's well said. It seems to me that lack of a question mark may be that this is very parallel to the earlier formulation where he says he most loved the task. Then we find out there's something that could get him to love it more. Okay? So as between these two competing things, love and need, the best is need as a right. But there can be something better. Mm-hmm. Next line begins, but, okay? Mm-hmm. But yield who will to their separation. I mean, you know, why should you yield to the separation of love and need here? My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation. As my true eyes make one in sight, brilliant image there. Mm-hmm. Okay? Only, now this is a very strong claim here, which you have to wonder in terms of the poem, has the poem driven us to the point where we say, yeah, in the world of this poem, this is right. Only where love and need are one. And the work is play for mortal stakes. Is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sake? Now, that's an amazing claim there. It suggests that getting back to the common good, the future, posterity, for heaven itself, this frame that we talked about way earlier when we asked why and by the time. For heaven's sake, let's assume heaven is the source of a call or vocation. The future, let's assume that's posterity. The deed isn't really done unless the love and the need are one, and unless the dramatic situation that we see, the separation, here are the tramps who want to do it for pay, here's he who wants to do it for love and not a choice, and unless somehow those two separate dramatic characters, one out of love, the other out of need, are made one.
That's why it's two.
Yeah. Avocation and vocation.
So isn't that what Friedman says?
Pardon?
Isn't that pretty close to what Friedman says?
Very close.
Your greatest joy and the world's greatest need.
Very close.
Mm-hmm.
Very close, I think. Although I'm wondering whether what he means by the work is play for mortal stakes. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a kind of particular kind of play going on here, and it's a kind of gamble. Stakes. No?
What does he mean by mortal stakes?
What do you think?
I'm not sure, because first I was saying I'm misreading this, future sakes. I thought for mortal sakes, and I said, no, it's for mortal stakes. And it just started me, I just haven't think.
One of the things is stakes of mortality. You know, do I need this in order to cook my supper? That's the mortal stake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like what we say, what is at stake here? What is
right. It's material. It's a material stake.
Do you buy that material stake? I think that's probably better. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Help me though. I don't understand what that means. Mm-hmm. And the work is play for mortal stakes.
The wood is unimportant.
Which work?
Wood is unimportant.
I get that part.
Well, that's what I think he's saying. If the work is play for mortal stakes, means if the wood is unimportant.
Okay. Oh, I see. Yeah.
But you see, if it were work for mortal stakes, that would be the tramps, okay? If it were play for mortal stakes, that would be the narrator. But if the work is play for mortal stakes, that's where you're sort of getting enacted in the words, the two eyes making one sight. The work is play for mortal stakes. All those have to be lined up, okay? It can't be pure play, it can't be pure work, the work has to be play, and the stakes have to be mortal. That's the reason I think the stakes work both as a kind of the stakes of life out of need and kind of go with a gambling metaphor of playing for stakes. Okay? I think, in other words, there's both of those, because one goes with work, one goes with play, and they both have to be together.
And the whole thing about mud time being you can go this way, it can go that way, is a kind of wager.
Exactly.
So I might need, as you said, could get cold tonight, I maybe do need this wood. Mm-hmm.
I think, too, in terms of mortal, that there may be a life and death choice here.
You want to unpack that?
Well, for these, the strangers, the lumberjacks.
Yeah.
Work or no work is kind of a life and death thing for them.
Exactly. And that's why he thinks need has a greater claim than love, precisely because their very physical existence could be at stake. And his is not. Here we're back to the word at stake, and back to the stakes here. So it's when work is play for mortal stakes that you have a kind of, I think, this melding of avocation and vocation. That can be done for heaven's sake. So in a way, if you look at the poem, you think, well, it's about vocation, but actually it's about the melding of avocation and vocation into something, okay? He wants to use the word vocation here, it seems to me, to mean work, not work as play, right?
I think so, yeah.
So he, insofar as he's influenced by the Christian traditions, he's influenced by that vein of the Protestant tradition that wants to reduce vocation to work, meaning paid employment, not labor, not just the expenditure of physical energy, as we see him at the beginning of this. He's not acting out of a vocation, according to this speaker, at the beginning. He's practicing an avocation, right? That is to say, avocation is the out of love, vocation is the out of need, okay? It's when you get those two together. So in a way, yes, he's like Buechner, but Buechner wants to use the bringing together of deep gladness and world's need to describe vocation, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to me, vocation is at its best when avocation is a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can read the speaker here.
Oh, yeah.
But then you shouldn't be chopping them in two parts.
That's right. Everything is, chopped in. We get this image of severing. He could have been doing any kind of work. Why does he get this cleaving so that they fall apart like a stone? And, you know, we didn't even have time. We had to go to dinner. But I think the season and the bird and the water and all of that is extraordinary and really does thicken out the texture of these kind of contraries in the way that work and play are not the same, but sort of the same, and you need both. And the same whole thing with the setting of this poem always. Well, but is it spring or is it really bad? Winter can change even moment by moment. And the bird's sort of doing its job, which is singing, but not really bidding any of the blossoms to open yet. I mean, doesn't want to invite them to open because it's still too cold. And the water
freezing over,
having this kind of menacing underside beneath the earth that comes out and shows its teeth at night. It's not just fluff to throw in three stanzas to describe it. It's the whole cosmos has this kind of character to it. The whole world, not just the tramp and the narrator in that kind of dramatic tension. The whole world has that kind of tension. Okay, well, thanks very much. I've kept you here 5 minutes early. You can still get to eat. And here's the Mark Percy poll, which I think is great. Yes.
Thank you.
And this gives you very much a different view of vocation.
Oh, I love this poem.
Because this basically does want to suggest that usefulness is crucial to the ones that she loves. She loves people who do useful work, and even things that are thought to be simply self-sufficient artifacts really were made for a particular kind of use. And by the way, when you go back and read this tonight, I find this fascinating. she too finds herself talking about life.
Right.
I find this very interesting. Very interesting that you can't write about this for very long without talking about mud, apparently. This subject of work and vocation. So I like this poem very much. That's another one that's going in the book. So if you have other poems or short stories or something that you think ought to go into this anthology, come up and see me. And be on these fundamental questions, not just on work, but on identity, on what gives life its significance and meaning and purpose, et cetera, et cetera. Anything that you love, I'll entertain for inclusion here and put you in the acknowledgement. So. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.